You're about to hear a recording of a live radio program. It's called Indivisible. You can listen live and call in four nights a week on public radio stations around the country or at indivisibleradio.com. You can also join the conversation with hashtag IndivisibleRadio or leave us a voicemail at indivisibleradio.com. Subscribe now so you don't miss a thing. Okay, here's the show.
This is Indivisible, Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
From WNYC Radio, I'm Kai Wright. Good evening.
And I'm Anne McElvoy, here from The Economist. It's Monday night on Indivisible. So Kai and I are both here to talk with you about the global context of the first 100 days of that Trump administration.
And later this week, President Trump will have one of his first big public tests on diplomacy. He's hosting Chinese President Xi Jinping at his Mar-a-Lago Country Club, and the entire world will be watching to see how these two leaders get on. The White House has already been talking tough in the buildup. Here's what Sean Spicer had to say about the meeting on Friday.
This isn't a sit around and play patty cake kind of conversation. They're big issues. The president's been making it very clear since for decades, frankly, of the challenges that we face. And I think he wants to have a very good and respectful and healthy relationship. But he also wants to make sure that he tackles the challenges and the problems that are facing American workers, American manufacturers, and get to them.
So tonight we're going to focus on a couple of huge issues that the U.S. and China are going to have to deal with together. Trade, as Sean Spicer pointed out there, and the climate, as he notably failed to mention. So we'll talk first about the overall U.S.-China relationship and in particular trade. And listeners, for this first part of the conversation, we want to hear from people who believe their livelihood is directly affected by our trade balance with China. It's currently about 4-1. We buy four times more goods from them than they do from us. Does this impact your work? Maybe you're a manufacturer or you work in manufacturing or maybe something else. But call us up, tell us what you do for a living and what you're hoping that comes out of the talks with the Chinese president this week. 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. And like I said, we'll get to climate in the second half of this show. But for now, if your work is impacted by trade with China, how so? What do you want to see from this meeting? 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. Or tweet us using the hashtag IndivisibleRadio.
Well, joining us now to talk about the upcoming visit from China's President Xi Jinping is Michael Oslin. Michael is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and he's author of a book, The End of the Asian Century. And it's been quite controversial because it's suggested that we might need to think again about China's foreign policy and its economic fate in the next years and what the right American response could be. So, Michael, hi, hello. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Anne. Glad to be with you.
Nice to hear you on the line there, but a little buzz on your line, not to worry. The strengths and weaknesses of the two sides, what are they? Because as they meet, each side seems to think that obviously they can get something out of this meeting. It's quite unusual for it to be taking place in somewhere like Mar-a-Lago. I would have expected it to be the full-on Washington treatment. But is this a sense of each side trying to show the upper hand in some way?
Well, you're not the only one who thought it should be done in Washington and that it would be, but it is clearly an attempt by President Trump to get the personal touch in and maybe have a bit of a dominant feeling over Xi Jinping. You know, this is how he prefers to negotiate. You asked about how each side is going to be coming in, and it's interesting. Ostensibly, Xi Jinping will be coming in with the wind at his back. You know, he had a very well-received speech at Davos just days before President Trump was elected, in which he seemed to snatch the banner of defender of global free trade and the global trade architecture from the United States. He has been going around the region and the world talking about Chinese investment and, in fact, in some cases, actively picking off American allies such as the Philippines and partners like Malaysia. But the reality is he faces an economy that is increasingly stressed, has increasing numbers amounts of bad news, and really has not come up with a major reform plan. Now, on the other hand, you have Donald Trump, who, sends out a tweet that causes a week of panic and paranoia throughout the United States and throughout the government, and then seems to recover from that only to send out another tweet. So both of them have the challenges, and both of them, I think, are going to take this as the opportunity to size each other up and figure just who has the more weaknesses.
There's a lot of Chinese officials having to sit there and look at a lot of Twitter over the weekends, I'm sure. Interesting you mentioned Davos. I was actually there at that meeting, and I thought in some senses there was a bit of a credulous response, really, to being told about free trade and openness and international rules by China, which is in controversy of quite a lot of them. But there was a sense that it was a bit of a play, wasn't it? It was moving into a space that Donald Trump seemed to have vacated by going for a more populist stance. But I'm curious, where does that leave the relationship now? Who wants to do what?
Well, that, I think, is what we're going to find out, certainly from the American side. The big problem, I think, that the president has going into this meeting is that he does not have yet an articulated Asia policy or a China policy, in part because he doesn't have his team in place. And this is something that people, at least in Washington, have focused on a great deal. You don't have the responsible officials who should be coming up with what the overall and broad strategy and policies are going to be. On the other hand, I think for Xi Jinping, it is probably to follow up what the Chinese felt was a very successful, from their perception, meeting with Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, in which Tillerson seemed to take a relatively soft line on all of the outstanding issues between Beijing and Washington, and in fact, and somewhat controversially, repeated almost word for word Chinese formulations of the nature of this relationship, win-win, cooperation, mutual cooperation, and the like. I think Xi Jinping wants to get Donald Trump to basically repeat that, to accept what is in essence China as an equal and the role for China. The problem, as you've noticed, I was just going to say, the problem is that just in the few days before this meeting, the president and his team have swung back to a much more aggressive tone on Twitter.
Oh, well, that's very interesting, because what I was trying to get my head around was this use of the term paper tiger, which has a history in Chinese diplomacy, or sort of undiplomacy, sort of rude way of talking about America, isn't it? It was sort of all hat no cattle, really, in sort of diplomacy speak. Mao used it, and now it's made a comeback. Some people were saying, well, this could be to do with the fallout over Mr. Trump's comments on the one China policy that he was thinking of revisiting it with, obvious territorial concerns for China. But it could be that he was just putting something on the table that he can retreat from in order then to show that he's given something. Do you buy that, or is that a bit too sophisticated for the diplomatic world we're in right now with Donald Trump in the White House?
Well, that is certainly one interpretation that, you know, even if the specifics aren't there, Trump has a relatively set negotiating style that he himself has told us, which is he pushes as hard as he can, he sets the bar very high, and then whether or not he continues to push, eventually he comes to some type of agreement. I think what's more interesting is that if you look at the, or equally interesting is that if you look at the trajectory of how this administration has gone about their first 100 days and pre, if you look at the transition period, obviously Trump came in after the election and building right off the campaign, having a very hard line on China. You mentioned the one China policy. Mm. He talked about labeling it a currency manipulator and slapping tariffs on it and the like. In fact, relinked the issues of economics and security and politics. But then, once they took office, very quickly that went away, and it was quieted down by the visit of Secretary Mattis to Japan and Korea, where he talked, instead of challenging China, that we would look for diplomatic solutions to the South China Sea crisis, and that was followed on by Secretary of State Tillerson. Now, it's not that they dropped every issue that was a problem between the two countries, but in essence, they took a much more accommodationist tone. Again, until just over the weekend, when Sebastian Gorka said that the islands that China was building in the South China Sea would not stand, and the president himself again began taking to Twitter to talk about how difficult a meeting this would be. That, to me, indicates that they have not yet really figured out what the policy is going to be, and that's where the danger is. The danger, I think, in this meeting is that they will either be simply reactive or that they will sort of swing again back and forth, which will lead to an instability that will prevent them from really establishing a baseline of relations for the next 4 years.
There's got to be a Chinese proverb for that. Thanks very much for that, Michael.
Listeners, we're talking with Michael Oslin from the American Enterprise Institute about the upcoming meeting between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping. And we want to hear from you if your company or your job or however you make your living has any relationship to our trade deficit with China. What do you want to see out of this meeting? 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. And let's bring in John from Des Moines, Iowa. John, welcome to Indivisible. You're on the air.
So nice to visit with you.
You as well. How does your work relate to our trade with China?
I work for a major manufacturer that is worldwide, and our wages are a fraction of what they were a generation ago in manufacturing, mostly because we don't have enough manufacturing jobs to go around for qualified employees. And our wages in this country are on a race to the bottom because we're being measured to a worldwide standard of pay.
And can you clarify? I'm sorry, John. So you are hiring in that company or you work in that company?
I work in that company. And over the last 20 years, our wages have fallen to below half of what they used to be. Benefits slashed, and not because the company's not profitable. It's because there aren't other jobs that this company can lose their employees to. We need healthy job base in this country. Otherwise, the manufacturing jobs that do remain still don't have to pay anything.
What kind of manufacturing job is it, may I ask? What kind of stuff do you guys manufacture?
It's agricultural manufacturing.
Okay. Michael, what do you think of this in terms of what could come out of this meeting? If you know, John feels like he's in a place, he's in Des Moines, Iowa. He's working in agriculture and manufacturing. He feels like there's not a lot of labor mobility, and that has something to do with our trade with China. Do you think there's something that could come out of this conversation that would improve John's situation?
Well, I think it's a broader question that the president has raised about fairness of trade. And I'm from Illinois, so I understand well what John's talking about. And this is something that goes beyond China, and it has gone on for decades. There are obviously different elements to the question of how you try at least first to stabilize the situation, and then, as the president promises, to reverse it, you know, bring some of these jobs back. One is the question of the free trade agreements and what he believes are that they are not fair, that we've been taken advantage of. And that is something that where China has had an outsized influence over the past, you know, basically since it got into the WTO back in the mid-1990s, is true. But that is also something that those jobs were disappearing and beginning to disappear long before that. Competition from Japan and from Korea and other lower cost producers. One other element that the president, you know, got a lot of attention during the campaign about was the question of currency manipulation. I think he's wrong in that China is actually, what they're trying to do is prop up the renminbi because of the macro weakness of this economy. But the broader question of exchange rates and the degree to which exchange rates in an open capital system have basically put at mercy what were American, competitive American companies, where they simply are unable, because of these larger financial structures, to be able to continue to compete for years, that has been draining away jobs from the country. But in order to do that, you really have to be willing, and I'm not sure even this White House is willing, to reverse what is, in essence, reverse the past 35, 40 years of global financial practice on the part of the United States, really ever since Richard Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard and let exchange rates float. There would be massive disruption with that. And until you until you do that, it's going to be very hard to see what type of incentives you can come up with in any trade agreement that would have a meaningful impact on bringing back manufacturing jobs. The president can get 100 here or 100 there with Carrier, but these are much broader trends that he's trying to reverse, and you have to attack it in some ways at the source, and it's not always going to be just a free trade agreement.
Let me move on to, and thank you, John, for your call. Let me move on to Zach in Oxford, Ohio. Zach, welcome to Indivisible. You're on the air.
Thank you. I actually was just talking about the currency manipulation. I feel that China has a lot more tools when it comes to these sort of negotiations. I'm sure your experts can comment on this. I work for a major manufacturer of construction supplies, and I know that China can undercut us with a couple orders from those in charge. While we have Congress, we have the Senate, we have companies that don't answer to the government directly. So I'm just afraid of what deals Trump's going to try to make when the Chinese president can do so much more.
Mm. So I guess let me add on to Zach's question for you, Michael. Is, you know, so he's saying, you know, if I gather this right, Zach, that you're worried about sort of what backdoor stuff Trump's going to do that we never even know about when he meets with the president. Is that correct, Zach? Is that it?
That and the fact that the Chinese can do. They have been manipulating their currency. We can't do that as easily because we respect global trade and follow the rules.
So here's what I don't understand, Michael, is, you know, it is, and I want to hear the answer to Zach's question about the whether there's some backdoor thing that Trump could do that no one would know about and would be bad. But also, when I hear my colleagues on the left, my economist colleagues on the left, they say China's been manipulating currency for years and it's a problem, and they've been dumping things on the world market, and that's a problem, and it's affecting the trade deficit. And then I hear Donald Trump say those same things. I hear you saying similar things, and you're from the American Enterprise Institute. You guys are pretty conservative. If everybody on the left and right agrees on this, why is there not action on it?
Well, so these are a lot of different questions that come in on the. Let me go first to the caller's question and Zach's question on the role of state-owned enterprises, in particular in China, and ways in which the government is able to act in the interests of business more directly, and in part domestically because it's giving tax breaks and it's giving preferred treatment at home, but then also negotiate abroad with sort of a what you would consider as a national economic strategy. You're picking which sectors of the economy you want to win, and then you're trying to negotiate pacts that benefit it. And I think that's absolutely right. It is what Japan did back in the 1970s. It is what China is doing today. It is also, we should note, a significant drag on the Chinese economy is the inefficiencies of these state-owned enterprises. And one of the big failures of Xi Jinping in his 4+ years as president has been to shrink the size of the state-owned sector. He has not done that. And in fact, even though by absolute numbers the state-owned sector is smaller, its influence and its role in the economy is larger than ever. And that is actually a negative for the Chinese economy. So I interpreted the question not so much as that Trump could do something backdoor, but that in essence he can't fight off what the Chinese would be doing to directly protect their industries. Interestingly, Trump's been trying to do that in some ways, initially by targeting American and foreign companies for not leaving the country. You look at the Carrier decision, what he did with Ford, the threats he made to Toyota, and he's been basically getting them to change some of their plans to offshore jobs and keep them at home. That's a different type of negotiation, obviously, than he would have with the Chinese, but I think Zach's right. Because of the system we have, you can't advocate directly on behalf, or at least as easily, for a company. In terms of the action, you know, it's basically, I think, because, first of all, China is changing.
Michael, let me interrupt you. We're going to have to take that after the break. We're going to take a quick break here. We're talking about how your work is impacted by the trade deficit. Stay with us.
This is Indivisible, Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
From WNYC Radio, I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm Anne McElvoy with you from The Economist. Now, China is crucial to solving the North Korea standoff that's arisen over that threat of nuclear missile testing from Pyongyang. Very worrying indeed. And we've seen a reasonably restrained response, Michael, from President Trump on that. Is that because he believes that he can put some pressure on China to deal with Pyongyang, or is Pyongyang and indeed the entire North Korean situation out of the control of anyone, even someone of the boundless self-confidence and ambition as the new president?
Well, we're certainly going to have that proposition tested. I think we have to recognize that Donald Trump has inherited a failed U.S. policy on the part of Republican and Democratic administrations alike. And if there's one area I think they can be cut some slack in, at least initially, it's in North Korea, where there's no one in Washington who believes that there's a good answer. It's the land of no good options, as everyone says.
But some options are always worse than others, aren't they, in particular when it comes to anything that deals with something so dangerous for the world?
Yes, I mean, you know, obviously a miscalculation on the part of the U.S. or its allies that causes Kim Jong-un to feel that he had nothing left to lose would be a tragedy. But, you know, short of that, you have a situation where no one really has real leverage. I think we're mistaken if we think that China has political leverage over Kim Jong-un. I think it's been made pretty clear that they don't. And you can see his actions in assassinating his uncle, who was Beijing's man in Pyongyang, certainly the most recent assassination of his half-brother, who was being protected by China, they don't have political leverage. They still do have economic leverage. And I think that the best card that the president can play is to threaten Chinese banks and companies that are abetting the North Korean regime to the tune of billions of dollars a year, and to threaten them with sanctions and other actions to get them, and there are hundreds of them, by the way, to get them to try to stop supporting this regime and giving it a lifeline.
But once he does that, Michael, he's backed off this idea, which is a very powerful one in international affairs. It's one that the way The Economist is founded on this principle that trade isn't just about trade. It's about keeping the peace. It's about peaceful cooperation and reliance on people in other countries and in different parts of the world. If you start to use it to you know, wave a big stick, it doesn't quite do the same thing, does it?
Well, I think certainly the idea that trade is to create a more cooperative world and a more cooperative set of relations is correct when you're talking in particular about nations that share similar values and similar regimes. I think it is being increasingly tested by relations between different species of regimes, so to speak, different types of governments, and the manipulation that you do see. If you have the sanction of international law talking about not supporting North Korean businesses or the government or the like, and then you have Chinese companies that are flouting it, you know, is using a trade cudgel really worsening relations between Beijing and the U.S., or is it merely responding to a situation in which the Chinese are the bad actors? And I think after, you know, almost a full generation now of failed world policy and U.S. policy towards North Korea, we may have to think more seriously about the types of sanctions that we'd want to be using against companies that, you know, by hook or crook or winking or nodding, are really keeping North Korea going.
Let's get one more call in on this question about how our U.S. trade deficit with China affects you and your work. We have Jared from St. Peter, Minnesota. Jared, welcome to Indivisible. You're on the air.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for taking my call. So my point was that I'm a union iron worker, and what I would like to see out of these talks is Trump either force China to make higher quality steel that they're going to sell in the United States and stop flooding our market with this poor quality steel that is just dangerous. And if China won't agree to that, then only use U.S. steel for U.S. projects.
So this steel dumping question, Michael, is another thing that it seems like people on the left, people on the right, both agree is a thing. It's happening, and it's exacerbating the trade deficit. Do you agree? Does Jared have a point?
Yeah, I think it goes back actually to what we were talking about when I sort of ran over into your break there, which is the fact that until now there have been so many incentives to cooperate with Chinese companies, you know, whether it was the finance on this end or sourcers on the other end, that really did not take into account what the effect was back home. The silent voices that were being affected, and so we could all say, well, we know there's dumping or we know there's unsafe products, but the fact was until now, the overall picture that there was growth to be got from China really ran roughshod over those other concerns. But I think that era is ending, and that's what I wanted to say was, first of all, China itself is changing. China, the economy is slowing down dramatically. The growth opportunities that are there, whether in terms of trade or finance, are slowing. They're not disappearing, but we'll recalculate them. And the costs, as Jared points out, the costs can no longer be ignored, both in China and outside of China, whether it's environmental devastation in China or some of the costs here at home. Free trade, the president is right, should be fair trade. And here, you know, he certainly seems to ally more with those on the left on this equation, which is not necessarily wrong, of course, to look at those impacts and to try to figure out, are we in a new era where maybe you will accept more inefficiencies or less opportunity for profit if what it does is, number one, resolve clear inequities such as dumping or currency manipulation, or what it also does is ensure that you have a stronger social system at home. Other countries do that. Japan, for example, has done that. And maybe it's time to think about that here. It requires a change in thinking, but you do have to carefully calculate out all of the implications, the economic implications, the political implications, and diplomatic implications of doing so. But certainly raising the question cannot be wrong.
Well, we're going to let Michael Auslan, author of The End of the Asian Century and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, go. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
It's my pleasure.
Bye, Michael.
And we're going to pivot because, as you can hear, there are a great many things to think about with the U.S.-China relationship, and one of those is the climate. So joining us now for that conversation is Andy Revkin, senior reporter for climate issues for ProPublica. He's been reporting on climate change since the 80s, mostly for the New York Times. And we're glad to have him. Andy, thanks for joining us on Indivisible.
It's great to be with you.
So listeners, we're pivoting again here for you as well. We were asking in the first half of the show how trade with China impacts your ability to make a living. We want to ask the same question about environmental protection and climate policy. What do you feel like are the financial stakes for you? Do you work in coal or in an industry that is impacted by climate change, either helping you or hurting you? Maybe you work in renewable energy. Whatever it is, we want to hear from you too. Call us at 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255, or tweet using the hashtag IndivisibleRadio. So first things first, there is, of course, widespread concern that even under the U.S., under the Obama administration, that the U.S. is not doing, had not promised to do nearly enough to deal with the consequences of climate change. That concern has been magnified for many people by the Trump administration's stance on a whole host of things. So let's just let's say the U.S. is not going to lead on this. Let's say they're not. You know, maybe something will change, but let's just take that as a given. The U.S. isn't going to lead on this. Now what? Can in fact China then step in as the global leader on this?
Well, you know, the first question is, what does leadership look like? In other words, what can countries do realistically? And even the ones that have this kind of green sheen around them, like Germany, which has had this big incentive for solar for a long time. When you really carefully look at virtually any country like that, you realize that there's not that much behind the sheen. There's a lot of questions about how aggressive everybody has been. So, and you know, again, as you mentioned, having reported on this since the 80s, since before there was a treaty, the first treaty, since before there was an IPCC, the climate panel, I've kind of come to the conclusion that Well, that's why I love being at ProPublica. It's because, you know, show me the data. You know, accountability is our thing. And the world...
I'm right with you there from The Economist.
Yeah, good.
We have data for breakfast.
Good
and
on you.
An extra sprinkling, even with evening drinks.
Wonk's rule.
Will Wonk save us?
No, but that's the thing. You know, one thing I spent the first 20 years writing about climate change, presuming that, well, actually the thing that needs to happen is better journalism. You know, if I just write the story a little more cleverly or put in a better graphic or do a documentary, which we did at the New York Times in 2005 on the Arctic change, well, then people will kind of get it. But I've come to the conclusion this is actually one of the hardest things that's ever faced humanity. It is a slow process. Even my friend Bill McKibben, who's in the city somewhere giving a talk tonight, I think, in Brooklyn. He's been at this.
Who runs 350.org.
Right.
Large climate change advocacy group.
But, you know, you listen to his rhetoric. It's all about, you know, go, 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 urgent action. But his life has been like this, get up in the morning and do what you can do kind of life. Every day, 30 years of now you're moving from journalism to advocacy in his case. And so the world's kind of like, if depending on how you want to look at this, we're kind of on track to a better relationship with the climate system, but we're always going to be behind.
But
no matter who's it, like, you know, it's not really Trump. As I wrote a piece, one of my first pieces at ProPublica was like putting Trump in the context of this, the actual problem, which has got the century scale to it. And Trump, he feels so dominant and he's dominated the news cycle. He's dominated a lot of my friends' psyches. but this issue is bigger than him. Both the solution factor, you know, how quickly we're going to move toward clean energy sources, and the scope of the problem is actually, it's going to take time. And it's way beyond like a one president thing. So that's the good news. The bad news is, again, it's a huge problem that it's going to take time. It's in my mind. And I'd be curious to hear listeners, you know, the rhetoric around this issue for a long time has been solve the climate crisis, like it was a leak in a dam that you just sort of like fixed, you know. But it's felt to me more and more in these last 10 years or so, increasingly, it's becoming kind of normalized in a way that it's kind of like defense or education or all the issues we deal with on a perpetual basis, where you don't, you
Andrew,
know.
Can I issue a little bit of a challenge on that?
No, I'd love to. Yeah,
Because I absolutely hear what you're saying, and I think all writers who deal with this and people involved in advocacy or indeed just exploring the arguments feel the same. It's like, oh, cool, climate change. You know, ooh, is it that time again? sorry, I know it's your day job, so you probably feel a bit more enthusiastic, but I do think that it suffers a bit from that kind of branding problem. So, have we gone the wrong way by these big? You know, trying to have these big conferences, these big agreements, many of which then don't seem to translate into practice. And not surprisingly, the readers, the listeners, the viewers just think, well, there was another thing that kind of half got done. And there's only a certain amount of that that busy people, probably going to hear in a second from callers, there's only a certain amount of that they can take on board.
Yes, actually, I don't see that as a challenge at all. I agree with you in the sense that the best thing about the last big meeting, the Paris Agreement, you know, tracking the diplomatic side of this since the beginning, since 1991, 92, it was the first agreement that actually reflected the shape of the problem. Because what Paris, like the world spent 20 years going from Rio way, way, way back in 1992 through Copenhagen in 2009, trying to get a treaty that looked kind of like a contract, you know, with binding terms and timetables and stuff. And Paris was the finally there was this recognition that's not going to work in a world with 196 countries with divergent development
the
stages.
The future of the planet contract was somewhat knocked back, wasn't it? We got something rather different.
Yeah, it won't be like that. It's in what Paris, what emerged in Paris, like the whole process was a journey towards some destination, like some magical thing that would solve the problem. And Paris created a journey. So it was the destination in Paris was a journey, a 100-year journey.
But still, I want to get back to this leadership question.
Totally.
Because nonetheless, leadership. Paris required a lot of leadership, you know.
Absolutely.
And if the United States is not going to be in that role, I hear you saying that, you know, beware the label of whoever claims that they're doing a good job, because no one really is. But still, particularly on China? Is there ways in which they can lead? I mean, last month, right, didn't they announce some significant changes in their own on their own in terms of taking offline or canceling a bunch of coal-powered plants that was unique and large? I mean, is there a leadership role that they could play?
Well, there is, although they're playing it. Again, when you look carefully behind the headlines, a lot of what China has done in the name of climate policy is really about domestic pollution policy. These are old power plants that are choking their cities and literally killing or sickening millions of people prematurely, and that impedes their economy. And what's also happened in China is, with the rise of middle class, for the first time they have a political reason to clean the air of the conventional pollution. The kind of stuff we did in the 70s, you know, the Clean Air Act, 70s to the 90s, we kind of did that. Now China's kind of doing that because they have a middle class, kind of like we did.
Right.
So it's not just climate leadership. You'll see they're heading toward peak coal for sure. But that's been, you know, the world is heading slowly, progressively away from these heavy carbon-containing fuels toward like natural gas is CH4. It's a C with four H's. It's not a ton of – it's not all carbon. It's fundamentally a cleaner fuel to burn than coal. And China, they want all the natural gas they can get. They're doing all the renewables they can get. They're still going to use more coal before they transition completely. Oh, and nuclear. So they're like the all of the above place. And they've done great things in lowering the cost of solar, for example. And that's where Germany should get some credit, because they created this subsidy for solar panels that allowed China to sort of ramp up its manufacturing and make them super cheap, so that now we can have an industry of people installing them on roofs. So China, you know, they're leading.
Not in unproblematic that sense. In Germany, it must be said, however.
No, I know, believe me.
Price, workability, just one of those things that's still a work in progress.
Let me squeeze in a call before we go to break. Mm. Danielle from Boone County, Iowa, you're going to get the last word before we go to break. Danielle, quickly, what would you like to chime in?
I live in a colony of China. Iowa is growing a lot of hogs that China consumes. It's polluted our air and our water. I teach environmental science, ecological restoration, and environmental ethics at two different universities. And my students are embracing the future with hope, with knives in their teeth, and some fear, because they don't think we will do the right things. They're not invested in this buy everything you can economy. They recognize that experiences are more important than accumulating goods, and they're ready to be asked to be challenged to lead us into the future. And I have solar panels on my barn roof. I make electricity. I don't consume it. I heat with wood. I eat venison. And we all must live bioregionally. And by the way, Andrew, I've got your book sitting on my bookshelf. I'm looking at it right now.
Cool. A plug for Andrew's book. What's the name of your book, Andrew?
Well, it must be very old because I haven't written a new one lately. But there was The North Pole Was Here. There was Global Warming. My Global Warming book came out in 1992.
It's bioregional. It's slow reading.
We're going to take a break. Knives in Their Teeth, Leadership from the Students in Boone County, Iowa. We're talking to Andy Revkin, senior reporter on climate issues for ProPublica, about U.S. leadership and the U.S.-China meeting coming up in Mar-a-Lago this week. We will be right back.
This is Indivisible, Public Radio's national conversation about America in a time of change.
From WNYC Radio, I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm Anne McElvoy from The Economist.
We're talking with Andy Revkin, senior reporter for climate issues for ProPublica, about the big meeting that's coming up this week between President Trump and President Xi. And amongst the things that we're curious about is who's going to lead on climate, if either. And we're taking your calls, too. We want to hear from you. If you feel like your livelihood is impacted one way or the other, for better or worse, by the efforts to control climate, control the consequences of climate change, give us a call, 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-8255. And on the subject of folks' jobs, Andy, let me play you a clip. This is, so President Trump has signed a series of executive orders rolling back a bunch of regulations from the Obama era, yeah, with the notion that they're going to spur job creation, particularly in coal country. And here's what he said as he was signing those orders.
Basically, you know what this says? You know what it says, right? You're going back to work. You're going back to work.
So he was talking to what appeared to be some coal workers lined up behind him, though there's some suggestion that some of those coal workers were actually coal executives. But is that true? Can this actually put people back to work in the coal industry?
There's a tiny prospect. There's a line of things that could be done. It's sort of like greasing a few gears to get some exports of coal. And slowing down the clampdown on regulations might have a little bit of an effect in terms of coal being competitive in a couple places, but overall, it's not the fuel of the future for sure. And as you've seen, countless, anyone tracking coverage of this from every standpoint, including from coal country, you see it's automation and all the same things that are taking away jobs in other arenas are a big chunk of the job loss in coal. And it's not like an American president can just sort of magically wave a wand and say, go back in the mines. It's just, for the most part, it's not going to happen. And you can't
is
wait.
Is that hopeful? So demand for coal has changed and is changing.
Has changed, and production, the way it's produced has changed. You know, these giant shovels out in Wyoming that dig out the coal there, it's not a job-creating thing. There's that macroeconomic effect of having energy. But we have abundant gas. Natural gas is every analysis over and over you think is like, okay, well, now we know there's a lot of gas. Then it's like, yes, and there's even more. Below the Marcellus Shale, there's another layer of shale that's, as soon as the price of gas will go up, then the drilling will proceed. And there's enough there for a lot of years going forward. And this is this bridge, you know, to a post-carbon world. It's not a coal bridge. And by the way, see, Trump has had this magical, he has waving two wands at once. We need more natural gas, one wand, and we need more coal jobs, two wands. But they're actually fundamentally competitive. You can't wave both of those wands at the same time. There's this kind of magical thinking, or, you know, I hate to think that there will be disappointment in coal country. I think people who might have had their hopes raised for whatever reason are not likely to see them assuaged or met.
Let's bring in Will from Tallahassee, Florida. Will, how you doing? Welcome to Indivisible. You're on the air.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. I just want to say that I listen to you every night after class, and I tell all of my friends to do the same.
Wow. After what kind of class?
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, it's graduate school, public administration.
Okay. Well, we're glad to hear it. So, how does your graduate school in public education connect to the energy questions that we're talking about here?
Well, it's not quite the school that that I wanted to talk about tonight. I've actually spent 10 years working in restaurants and hospitality, and then my dad did it for 35 years before me. And you know, we live in Florida. We're surrounded on three sides by water. I think only Hawaii has us beat there. I definitely feel that, you know, the more the United States ignores the climate issue, the more we suffer here, specifically in Florida, because we depend so much on that tourism revenue.
Mm. Well, Florida is sea level rise in Florida are not friends, at least the Florida that the humans enjoy. Florida has been underwater before, and it'll be underwater again. It's a question of the pace of change. The rate of sea level rise is highly uncertain. It's one of the parts of the climate picture. We know, you know, the basics are clear. Greenhouse gases actually work. They make the world warmer than it would otherwise be. But the pace of sea level rise between now and, say, 2100 is still kind of uncertain. But as the New York Times, my buddies, I was at the Times for a long time, recently reported, you're already seeing routine flooding, not even storm-related flooding on Florida's coast, and also other parts of the East Coast, because it's an area where sea level rise is having more of an impact already. The Atlantic is kind of sloshy. The west side of the Atlantic, meaning the east coast of Florida, is more vulnerable. The rate of sea level rise will be higher, quicker there than elsewhere. So, and interestingly, by the way, Florida is one of the places where there are Republicans quietly in the background who are working on resilience policies, even as the Trump administration is trying to cut budgets for those things.
Well, and interestingly, too, I mean, you know, he's talking about hospitality jobs. Will was talking about hospitality jobs, which is not a job sector one thinks of when you think about climate change. I wonder about, you know, what are all the ways beyond coal where we might lose jobs if we don't do something?
Well, the things, you know, look at it was in Thailand 4 or 5 years ago where the supply chain for hard drives, I think it was hard drives, got completely disrupted by epic flooding. And they had built these factories in areas that were floodplain. And anyone who's not thinking about that, any business can be vulnerable to disrupted supply chains. We live in a global economy, and where your widgets come from or your food or whatever can be very disrupted by these kinds of climate-related events. So that's kind of there'll be these. Oh, and I'll give you one last example. You know, the New York City reservoirs. I used to write about the regional environment for a long time, and everyone thought, well, the reservoirs, you know, they'll be vulnerable to like drought or, you know, or. But it actually turns out one of the things that happened around 1999, I covered, there was this winter heavy rain, super rainstorm, and after snow, and the reservoirs got all muddy. Turbidity, it's called. And turbidity is not your friend if you run a water supply system, because bacteria and stuff like to grow in that silty part of water. So the city was suddenly thinking, oh my gosh, this isn't just like about running out of water. It could be about silty water from heavy rain. It's not. It's like too much rain isn't necessarily good, even if you're thinking about water supplies. So those kinds of unanticipated consequences are there for water systems, for the way we work and move. You know, we're so mobile and connected now that it'll be some of the things that'll happen will be things we haven't thought of. Or if you're not thinking in that, that's what resilience thinking is.
Let's take a look, though. Could we just take another look at perhaps at the other side of the argument and talk about Scott Pruitt, Trump's EPA administrator, so environmental protection is his bailiwick. And he fits into that category, which is sometimes called climate science denier. And so listen to this from a CNBC interview last month when he was asked if he believes that carbon dioxide was the primary driver of climate change. And here's what he said.
No, I think that measuring with precision human activity on the climate is something very challenging to do, and there's tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact. So no, I would not agree that it's a primary contributor to the global warming that we see.
Oh, that's such a funny, you know, it's a classic dodge, because it's like saying you're approaching an intersection on a highway and you're arguing about the speed of the truck that's coming the other way. Is it coming? Is it 75 miles an hour? Well, I'm not.
Well,
we can't really.
You preempted my question.
But, okay, sorry. I just couldn't.
Scott, but it's slightly different actually, because you shouldn't get away with everything without another challenge. So,
sure.
What I suppose I'm thinking there is, you could accept the first part of his statement that there is still tremendous disagreement about the degree of impact, that if it's, you know, if climate change works out over a certain period of time at 1 degree, that's different from 2 degrees, when it really starts to get very dangerous indeed, and obviously thereafter lies catastrophe. So do climate change acceptors, we've talked about the deniers, they always get the rude word, do the acceptors need to be a bit more precise about what we actually know?
No, in fact, it's the opposite. I think the acceptors have implied too much precision. I've written a lot about the 2 degrees threshold. There isn't a magical threshold. It's a political threshold. And if you look carefully at the history of that number, it's not like science has determined that after 2 degrees, all the glaciers melt and all the reefs broil. And that, I think, has enabled...
But you said he had a dodge, but isn't it a bit of a fudge, if not a dodge, to say, well, any amount is really bad? Because people will quite naturally say, well, can you tell me how much is containable and how much isn't?
I think this is an arena. It's called risk management, where if you look carefully, the things that matter most about the climate system, despite the clarity on the basics, are the things that matter most are the least certain. The rate of sea level rise, how much warming a certain amount of CO2 buildup in the atmosphere will bring. And there's a whole science. There's a website. I love that. I went to this meeting in Washington. It's the Society for Decision Making Under Deep Uncertainty. There is such a thing. It's deepuncertainty.org. Go there, readers, listeners, right now.
Very good departmental name.
And it's people from the RAND Corporation and the military and weather forecasting. Right. We live with deep uncertainty and make decisions all the time. And what's happened, I think, is on both ends of the spectrum, there's been too much of a as I said, I think people like Scott Pruitt, and you saw this over and over again in the hearings, the confirmation hearings. Yeah. We don't know, therefore we don't do anything. Mm. And it's just that not
well,
that
exactly.
kind of
the
problem.
Well, exactly. The fact, even if you don't know, it doesn't mean you don't have to do something.
And rather, it's the opposite. Yeah, you don't know, you should act.
Just to give you one more sense, then you end up in this like weird world where you think, well, if more science happens, it'll magically make things simpler. And maybe this is where longevity comes in. You know, hurricanes, when I was writing about this in 1988, everyone thought, well, warmer seas mean more hurricanes. You know, hurricanes thrive on hot water. And now it's like the 30 years of science has made it ever more complicated. It's like there'll be fewer hurricanes overall in a warmer world, but the ones that form have a higher chance of being stronger. So if you're the mayor of a coastal city, does that matter much to you? Not really. It just means if you're in a coastal zone prone to hurricanes, hurricanes are bad, therefore make sure you're prepared for them. But it doesn't mean that 30 years of science made it simpler. And that's an issue that I think people have to understand.
All right, well, let's get Don from Philadelphia into this conversation. Don, welcome to Indivisible. You're on the air.
Awesome. How are you guys?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing great.
What would you like to chime in about?
So one of the things I wanted to bring up is that, you know, that we were talking about the different industries that people don't expect to be impacted by climate change. And, you know, one of the things we're trying to deal with on the beekeeping side is the sort of death of a thousand cuts we've been dying from over the last, 20 years or so. We're trying to isolate the variables for why our bees are dying, and having the weather change dramatically on us in the midst of that is, you know, we're trying to hit a moving target at this stage of the game. And, you know, it's complicating matters. You know, the flowers coming into bloom ahead of when our bees are ready for them. And, you know, we're trying to move bees off into other areas just to accommodate that. So it's really going to make things harder rather than easier for us going forward, I suspect.
Don, what does that mean for you, like running a business? Those kinds of unexpected changes.
It means that instead of leaving my bees in Philadelphia, I have to ship them down to Georgia. You know, we just did that for the first time this year. To try and get them out of this sort of weird winter that we were having. You know, when the bees build up, when it gets warm and then it gets drastically cold right after, you know, they can lose a lot of those baby bees that they were just getting started. And this kind of like up and down, really hurts us. So, you know, what we're looking for is consistency.
Like with any business, right? You know, predictability.
Yeah. And in the face of that, you know, we're just talking about, you know, deep uncertainty. I mean, every year we're coming into fall going, how's this winter going to go? It makes things hard.
Thanks for that, Don. Let's go to Catherine in Highland, New Jersey. Catherine, you're on the air. Welcome to Indivisible.
Hi. I have so much to say, but all of your topics this evening have been fantastic.
Well, pick one of them.
Well, your previous question about linking how the energy industry affects you, I'm a recent graduate. I just got out of grad school, currently teaching at a university, but my major was in marine biology. So while the energy industry doesn't directly affect me, this lack of support for the science community as a whole, I'm directly affected in that way. And my thought just through the entire Trump campaign was, you know, you can't bring back coal jobs. There's not enough usable coal for us, and we need to start investing in renewable resources and really looking at the issues that do face our planet as a whole, because as we've seen throughout the whole show, all aspects of industry are going to be affected from this climate change. We're not proactive about it. So that was just my comment on that.
Thank you, Catherine. Let me ask you, Andy, sort of thinking about industries that are impacted that we don't think about, what about, you know, actually carbon producers, and this idea that we have a carbon bubble right now, and that part of the issue is that all of these reserves that are the value for carbon companies now will quickly become devalued when at some point, and we need to manage the walk down of those assets, or we would have a big crash, and that this is what a lot of like the bankers and the global finance people are scared about. What about that? Is that
the liability, the sort of shareholder liability aspect of it? The issue, I just today and tomorrow and Wednesday, there's a meeting in Brooklyn, of all places, the Sustainable Energy for All meeting. It's a UN.
You go to a lot of creatively named meetings.
Yeah, but this is commitment and the Sustainable Development Goals that we, by 2030, the world will have full, among many things, full access to modern energy services. And you, the people who are there from developing countries, you know, energy needs in most places continue to trump climate concerns. If you are burning firewood and would prefer to burn propane, the fuel that we all enjoy in our backyard grills, and if someone at some European foundation doesn't want to have that available to you because of climate concerns, it's not going to be salient in a country where there's no energy access. So that's the counterpoint to the idea that the climate concerns will cause us to prematurely abandon, well, let's say natural gas for sure. Oil and natural gas are going to be around a lot longer probably than coal. Yeah. Coal has all these downsides, you know, direct pollution and stuff. So those assets, the coal assets, we're already seeing that. You know, the coal companies are already kind of in trouble. And there does seem to be a global, there'll be more coal used before we're through this carbon pulse. But that'll be the first thing to go. But gas, oil, profound needs are going to not magically go away too quickly.
To come sort of full circle on my initial question on who's going to lead on this thing. So if the federal government doesn't lead quickly, can states lead? Is it reasonable to believe that states could take over this and fix it?
Well, just today at this meeting, actually, states and cities, cities have been sort of vying for the leadership role. Former Mayor Bloomberg was over there, and he's been pushing this idea for a long time. But I heard, you know, interesting things like cities in Europe are starting to banish diesel cars from their downtowns, and that could end up being this pulse of sort of a shift in what car companies choose to make, because cities are sort of nudging their way into a leadership role. So that's possible. But I love the idea that the students in Iowa with the knives in their teeth, to me, they're the leaders. And the worst thing that could happen right now is for Trump to defund basic science, and so that people aren't like in a position to lead.
Science and students. Thanks to Andy Revkin of ProPublica for joining us. And thanks to you for all of your calls. You've been listening to Indivisible. This is Public Radio's national conversation, airing four nights a week for the first 100 days of the new administration. Tomorrow on Indivisible, WNYC's Brian Lehrer talks to conservative talk show host Hugh Hewitt and progressive MTV news correspondent Anne Marie Cox about Russia and surveillance. And we're going to launch a new experiment between Indivisible and StoryCorps. You'll hear more about that. I'm Kai Wright.
And I'm Anne McElvoy from The Economist.
Talk to you next week.
Support for Indivisible is provided in part by Emerson Collective, the Ford Foundation, and the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation.
If you like The Indivisible podcast, rate and review it and tell your friends. And thanks for listening.